Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
My name is Daniel Baker. I'm the director of the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I'm also a professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences and a professor of physics here at CU Boulder. I'm a researcher doing work in the areas of space physics and planetary science. I'm involved in several different NASA missions and several NSF programs, but one of my primary research interests is really about the space environment, its effects on human technology, what we now call space weather. Yes, I've been involved in space weather research even before it was probably called space weather research. My involvement goes back, I've really traced my involvement back to my earliest undergraduate work with James Van Allen and subsequent work at the California Institute of Technology with Edward Stone. But probably first recognition of how important the applied side of our discipline is really came about in my early work as a staff member briefly and then as a group leader at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. There I really worked on programs that were often involving classified kind of research, but looking at the effects of the space environment on what we would call operational satellites, trying to understand whether the effects that were being seen, operational anomalies on spacecraft, were caused by the environment or something more nefarious. And so I really began to realize that the basic scientific work we're doing of trying to understand the sun, understand the variability of the sun, understanding the variability of the space environment that's often driven by solar changes, really can have profound effects on the operation of space systems and ground systems. And so from those earliest days, and this would date back to the 1980s, let's say, of understanding the dramatic effects that the space environment can have on technological systems, I really got very engaged in that at that time, and it's continued to be an interest as well as a passion and a vocation for me to pursue those kinds of questions. Yeah, there were many key events, I would say, many turning points in the way that space weather has evolved, but I would again trace a lot of things back to the working as a researcher, as a scientist at the Los Alamos National Lab, of seeing that there were events that were a complete puzzle to the people in the Department of Energy or in the U.S. Air Force, complete puzzle as to why certain things were happening to their operational sensors. And then being able to look at the corresponding kind of scientific data, understanding the And seeing what the sun was doing at the same time as some of these operational anomalies, a light bulb sort of goes on when you see that very disruptive events occur only under certain space physics or certain geophysical kind of conditions. And so that was really very rewarding to me. I found it very rewarding to know that I was advancing, pushing back the frontiers of space science, but also being able to use that improved understanding to help important national programs perform better and at least anticipate when those kinds of operational problems might arise. Going forward a bit further, as I moved from Los Alamos to the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, I also got very involved there in looking more at the kind of operational systems that NASA was running. For example, the TDRS satellites, the large communication satellites that at geostationary orbit that NASA operates. There, too, I was able to use the expertise that I developed in understanding the space radiation energetic particles and their variability to help those people at NASA who are working with contractors to try to improve the design of major spacecraft systems and to improve operational capabilities. And of course, moving on into the later part of the 90s and into the 2000s, being here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, I've worked very closely with my friends and colleagues at the Space Weather Prediction Center at NOAA, here just across town. And once again, we've developed some, I think, remarkably useful tools. Among these has been a system that takes observed space weather information, such as solar wind speed, and through numerical prediction techniques allows the NOAA people to predict what the energetic particle environment in the magnetosphere is going to be. It's been used for a number of years now. I'm very gratified by that. Also have been involved in working with many other colleagues through NSF-supported work, such as the Center for Integrated Space Weather Modeling, to help see that the so-called Wang-Scheele RG-Enlil model, a model that observes the sun and then uses those observations to predict what the solar wind properties near Earth are going to be, to really see that go from a strictly research kind of a tool to now a truly operational space weather tool that's in the operating in the National Center for Environmental Prediction. So over the decades, I would say that my work has gone from being very science-oriented to being a work that tries to identify when there could be a good link or a good hook to the more national needs, international needs, and especially operational system needs, and to be able to make those kind of connections. And it's a gratifying thing to be able to do both basic research, but also research that has a strong public purpose. Yeah, when I use the word operational, it's a very encompassing term. It really can mean satellite systems, for example, communication satellites or reconnaissance satellites operating, for example, at geostationary orbit. It can also mean satellite systems such as the Global Positioning System satellite constellation that's operating at about half geo altitudes. It can involve low altitude spacecraft communication and remote sensing kind of spacecraft. But I hasten to add that a lot of the work we're doing now has relevance to what are really ground-based systems. This can include the electric power grid, and it can include comm systems, communication systems that involve radio communication or other such things. So we have really, as a society, have built a cyber-electric cocoon that goes from, I suppose you might say, from the surface of the Earth or even below the surface of the ocean all the way to sort of the farthest reaches of our Earth's magnetosphere. And all of those are extremely interesting scientifically, but they also are the home for many systems that we rely upon for our daily societal needs. And so I really use the term operational to include all the things that we as a society depend on. Yes, I, while not an astronaut myself, I have been very interested in how the effects of the environment on humans in space has occurred. And of course, again, my work involvement goes back probably to the 1980s or so, when longer duration kind of human spaceflight was really getting underway. And a lot of my research was directed toward understanding very energetic particles as are trapped in the Earth's radiation belts, also as result from powerful coronal mass ejections and solar flares from the sun. And understanding those high energy radiations and how they interact with both robotic and human life forms in space really has been another gratifying aspect of this, to be able to take our very basic research and to try to understand how these high energy particles occur, when they will occur, when they won't occur, trying to provide both alerts and warnings for the times when the most severe space radiation is going to occur, but also trying to provide green light kind of conditions when things will be benign and relatively free from risks to human and other life in space, has really been an important component of this. And, you know, we recognize that the radiation in space is one of the really tall poles when it comes to threats, and it's really one of the most sort of immutable risks that we have for humans having long-duration spaceflight. And so trying to develop a deeper physical understanding of the sun, of the magnetospheric environment, other places where humans will be operating, and being able to provide genuine long-term as well as short-term prediction of the space radiation changes is probably one of the most important things NASA can pursue. Well, the issue of being able to make predictions about the space environment is an intriguing one. Often it's attributed to either Niels Bohr, if you're very intellectual, or to Yogi Berra, if you're not so intellectual, but the statement is that predictions are hard, especially about the future. And what we, of course, recognize is that our chances of predicting what's really going to be disruptive to human interests really has to start pretty early with very deep fundamental understanding of the sun, the variability of the sun, the variability of the space environment, ultimately the things that are going to reach and impact the near-Earth environment. And so I think if you look at what's happened over the last, say, decade or slightly more than a decade, the progress has been tremendous in our ability to issue accurate predictions, forecasts, alerts. And I think it's really come about because we have been looking back further and further in the sequence of events, the chain of events that ultimately leads to a disruptive space weather event, looking more deeply and trying to peer even into the interior of the sun through helioseismology, keeping a very close eye on the sun, active regions on the sun, getting a deeper understanding of which active regions are most unstable, when they might go unstable. All of these things sort of precondition us to be ready to act pretty smartly when a major solar disturbance day occurs. But then having the observing platforms, not only from the earthward point of view, but around the sun, to look at the three-dimensional sun in as much detail as possible, and then feeding that information as quickly as possible into numerical models, into predictive models, and being able to follow that outward. We, of course, have a long way to go in order to have absolutely precise and accurate forecasts and alerts, but we've come further faster than I think almost anyone could have imagined, say, a decade ago. And it gives me great optimism that we are going to be able to continue to improve our insight, our physical understanding, and that this is going to go from insight to foresight. And that kind of progression is just what we need in order to serve societal needs, in my opinion. Well, it's to me, it's a very interesting thing. I go back often to the kind of ideas of Arthur C. Clarke, who said that information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not wisdom, and wisdom is not foresight. We have to continuously progress along that of taking all the vast information we now have about the space environment, about the sun. We have to convert that information into actionable kind of knowledge. And actionable knowledge to me really means to develop the wisdom to understand what's important about the system, what's less important, and then to be able to convert that to the real kind of foresight that will provide for the needs of human society. We've seen in recent times that that models that start out to be just curiosity-driven research kind of models can be adapted, can be utilized, and there's nothing as useful for improving our insight as to try to predict real-world circumstances, figure out why we didn't do so well, go back and tweak things, and continuously improve the process, the chain. And this, I believe, has been one of the most important components of the dramatic improvement in capabilities over the last decade, has been going from simply curiosity-driven science to this research, which I like to say is basic research with a high public purpose. Well, I would like to relate to you one experience. It's quite recent, actually, and I might also relate to you something from longer ago. But I have often thought, what does it take for us to communicate as a research community to policymakers? And just completed a paper which just appeared online for the journal Space Weather. And it looks at an event that occurred a little bit over 1 year ago in July of 2012. And the wonderful NASA spacecraft Stereo A, was observing the sun, saw a hugely powerful coronal mass ejection, a halo kind of event headed clearly right toward the spacecraft. All other NASA assets, the Earth and the other inner planets of the solar system, were all sort of congregated diametrically opposite to this spacecraft in their orbits. But this coronal mass ejection went from the sun to the spacecraft in about 18 hours. This is immensely fast. The original clock speed was something like 3,500 kilometers per second, one of the fastest coronal mass ejections ever seen. And so we were very curious about, this is a hugely powerful event. If this had occurred a week earlier, it would have hit the Earth. But we've often asked for, we've sort of in our minds asked for a demonstration kind of experiment that wouldn't really harm all of the Earth and human technologies, but would still allow us to sort of look at how bad can space weather get. And this was a very nice, very convincing to me demonstration kind of experiment. And so we've taken the observations from the STERRIO-A spacecraft, run them through our models of what would have happened at the Earth. We began to see that this storm, had it occurred, had the Earth been in the way, would have been larger than any storm, a solar storm or geomagnetic storm, that occurred in the 20th century. And in fact, in many ways, would have been comparable probably to the storm, the famous storm, observed by Richard Carrington in 1859, so 150 years ago. To me, this is a very recent illustration, a shot across the bow, if you will, a demonstration of the sun's power, even during what many would call a relatively weak solar activity cycle. Some have called this a wimpy solar maximum. But what we see is that the sun, even at its wimpiest, is capable of hugely powerful outbursts, and that oftentimes it's more a matter of timing and luck than it is anything else, whether the Earth is going to be impacted or not. So we don't have to go back 150 years into the moldy old records of the Victorian age to really see a solar storm that would have been absolutely devastating, in my opinion, to human technology. So what do we do with this? It seems to me that we as a society should learn the lessons of the present as well as the past. We should take this kind of experience, this kind of demonstration that that nature has chosen to perform for us, use it to good effect, play it through our models, play it through our societal dependencies, and in a sense, war game the whole business of space weather to now understand what if this storm had occurred a week earlier and the Earth had been in the line of fire rather than just one of Earth's emissaries, STERRIO-A, and really use this for power companies, for spacecraft operators, for communications needs. All of the things that we depend on so much, we now have a good object lesson that's been performed by nature, and we ought to learn good lessons from it. So that's to me, that's an interesting recent development, and one that I think we should all pay heed to. The other thing I'd like to say is that while space weather has been a much-used term in the literature, in publications in the last decade, it really goes back to probably the earliest times. And I talked about one of my early mentors, James Van Allen, and after visiting with him and giving a talk at his 90th birthday party, he sent me a very kind letter. And in it, he just remarked that he was very interested in the work that I was doing on space weather, but that in many ways, he considered himself from his earliest days to have been involved in space weather too. So even his work going back to the 1950s and 40s, Van Allen recognized that the thing we now call space weather has been almost seamlessly linked back to the earliest work in the space age, back at the beginning of the Sputnik era. And so we shouldn't think that we've just invented this recently. It's really something that's been with us for a long, long time.
I hope you enjoyed this Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.